On ABC local radio, you with Rod Quinn. Time to talk health and fitness. Gordon Lynch is the Professor of Physiology at the University of Melbourne and speaks to us about health and fitness every week. Gordon, good morning.
Good morning, Rod.
This morning you want to talk about muscle and bone and how important bone health is for muscle performance.
To me, I find this a fascinating topic. It's about really how hormones secreted by bones and muscles are having a big impact of our understanding of all physiology. And you know, in the old days, years gone past, we used to think bones and muscles were essentially static tissues that had hormones directed to them, that they didn't excrete their own hormones. But in fact, we're learning more about this now. Both bone and muscle can release hormones. And the focus of this morning is based upon this wonderful study that's just been published in the journal Cell Metabolism. It's a very prestigious journal. And they describe how our bones produce a hormone called osteocalcin that can increase our exercise performance. It's released by the bone, which then affects the muscle to make the muscle work better. And it's a wonderful paper, very exciting one for me to see this. This hormone, osteocalcin, has been measured before, and it's shown to naturally decline as we get older. And it starts earlier in women in terms of the decline. Around about age 30, it starts to go down. Men around about the age of 50, these levels of osteocalcin that are being measured start to decline. But as we exercise, this hormone is being produced, and it can actually make muscles work better in terms of exercise performance and so on. So it's something that I think I'd like to investigate a little bit more with you if possible, but that's the crux of the story, is that our bones are producing a hormone that can explain why we can exercise and hopefully exercise for longer.
Okay, so you say it naturally starts to decline as we get older, so how can we either delay that or stop that by whatever they're suggesting in this research?
Yeah, so this research looked at it in different ways. They looked at just the basic levels of this osteocalcin, and they did studies in mice, and they did also measure levels in monkeys and in humans as well. So in mice, they found that during exercise, the levels of osteocalcin spike. So in younger animals, when they start exercising, they spike to a level which is much higher, four times the level of what it is when the mice were older. So the three-month-old mice could run for, say, well over a kilometre before they became exhausted. The 12-month-old mice could only run half of that. And it's not just because of osteocalcin, but the levels of osteocalcin were much lower in these older animals. So what they did, they did this very sophisticated engineering, tissue engineering and genetic engineering, and they made the signalling that allows this secretion of this hormone to be interfered with. So if you don't have osteocalcin being produced and then impacting on the muscle, the mice were running 20 to 30% less distance, time, and so on, than when they were before. So this hormone was having an important effect, and its secretion was having an important effect on how far the animals could exercise. So when the animals were much older, so healthy mice, as they get older, these levels were decreasing. When they were injected with this particular hormone, osteocalcin, the exercise performance matched that of the young mice. So the older mice were able to run, you know, well over a kilometre before they became exhausted. So this idea of restoring the levels of osteocalcin improved muscle function to what it was when they were younger. So that was, a very important finding. And in terms of the levels in monkeys and in humans, the same thing was shown. It starts to decline younger at an earlier stage in females than in males. And the researchers sort of tried to explain this from an evolutionary perspective, that during evolutionary times, men were more active than women in hunting and fishing. That's why they may have required a higher level of circulating osteocalcin being released from their bones during that activity. And that may be an explanation why the decrease in circulating osteocalcin occurs later in men than it does in women. Now, the idea behind this, why this hormone is having this effect on muscle, is that It's actually causing this crosstalk between the bone and the muscle, and there's also other organs involved as well. The liver's involved, the pancreas is involved. They're releasing factors that enable the muscles to work for longer. So we've got glucose uptake by the muscle improved, the free fatty acids that are being uptaken by the muscles improved, the ATP, which is the energy source for the muscle for longer term duration activities, was also being improved by this hormone osteocalcin. So the bone releasing a hormone which then acts on muscle to enable the muscle to do more. It's a fascinating story, and it has major implications, I think, for human health, that if we can tap into this concept that we've got a hormone there that can improve muscle from the bone, then perhaps it can be manipulated in a way to improve human health.
Gordon Lynch, our guest, talking about this extraordinary breakthrough, we think, in this hormone, this osteocalcin. Calcin. So osteo being bone, calcin, I presume, to do with calcium.
Yep.
So does that mean that as we get older, maybe an injection is all we need, or a series of injections to return us to health or fitness of an earlier time? Or is it something there maybe where the hormone just gets tweaked somewhat? How does it work? What is the advantage for human beings, and how will they be able to access this at some point?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. It's still early days to speculate that this would be a magical way of changing our health. But the evidence that's been shown in these particular studies, in frailty, where we've got an inability to exercise, maybe because of a variety of different things, but with our fuel levels within the muscle are depleted, or we've got an inability to do with some form of activity. This, an injection of osteocalcin, for example, and I'm speculating, but this is an example, if we had an injection of osteocalcin, it may improve the ability for someone to actually do some form of physical activity. And I like that concept that if you're able to do some physical activity, you can do more physical activity and then get this release of osteocalcin as well. So, you know, you can have a normal level of osteocalcin, but it could be supplemented to a level much like it was when you were younger, and therefore improve the performance of someone who's unable under normal circumstances to do physical activity. The other things to consider, and I think we always look to the dark side of these things when we think of hormonal manipulation and sports performance, that it could be misused in a way. So this is something to watch as well, that if we don't know what happens if you have too much osteocalcin, and that could be a factor as well. That could have maybe have damaging effects on bone or muscle if you have too high levels. That hasn't been investigated as yet. But the potential for it to enhance performance from the old into the younger and restore that level of performance is an exciting one. And certainly if we talk about just normal muscle performance and then for athletic performance, certainly that's going to be an avenue that would be investigated. I like to think of it more for things like rehabilitation. If someone's unable to do exercise, or they've been physically incapacitated because of muscle injury or something else, that maybe this is another way that we could restore function to the muscle and get someone active and improving their quality of life. The other thing, when we're talking about restoring the normal function of muscle and the way that this hormone is acting on the muscle by improving glucose uptake and utilization of that glucose and free fatty acids and so on, it could be used in a therapeutic sense for helping with type 2 diabetes or diabetes generally, where we've got insulin issues. So I think that's still to be examined. I'm speculating again, but the possibilities are there. And that's why it's an exciting area, and why I really think this is a great study, because it opens up so many different areas for human health, where this knowledge can be then used in a way which could benefit many people who are otherwise unable to be affected so far.
But is there always a correlation between what happens in mice and what happens in humans? Because I know they do a lot of tests on mice, so obviously there must be some correlation. But just because it works in the mice, does it mean it works in humans?
For the most part, then it's not. Of course, there's always caveats, and it doesn't always hold. That there will be some difference in particular levels, and it may be up in one species and then down in another. But generally speaking, we're talking about mammals, and you know, if we talk about the evolutionary conservation between mammals across from mouse, rat, rabbit, horse, dog, etc., all the way through to primates and humans, there is a remarkable conservation. So we get very good clues about how it may affect human health by seeing how these changes occur in animals. And in particular, when we're looking at medical research, mice and rats are typically the ones where we can say, well, this is a way that we can test them and then hopefully go into clinical trials testing them in patients. But they have to do an exhaustive array of different tests before we can enter safely into trials on humans. So the possibilities are there. When we think about this as well, I often talk about exercise and the benefits for bones. Clearly, some types of exercise are going to be better for us, for our bones, than others. If we think about the extreme case of ultra marathon runners and endurance cyclists, in fact, the cyclists actually have weaker bones because they're not load-bearing exercises. They're spending so much time in a non-load-bearing state that their leg and hip and joint bones are weaker than that would they be for compared with an ultra marathon who's pounding the pavement and loading up the bones on a regular basis. So certain types of exercises are going to be better for our bones than others. And that's certainly how I try and talk about bone-friendly exercises. We should be thinking about incorporating exercises which are loading bones in a way. So weight-bearing activity, and I talk about walking as being the mainstay of our programs. If we're starting from scratch, we haven't done exercise before, we get the all clear to exercise from our doctor. Walking for most able-bodied people is the exercise of choice, and it's a good one because it's load-bearing. But as we get a bit more involved with our exercises, we need to think of other ways to load the bones in a healthy way. So strength training, you knew I was going to mention that. That's a good exercise because it's a dynamic exercise as it puts the bones under pressure, causes them to bend slightly and puts that torsion on the bones. That stimulates the bone to produce more bone cells. So the idea of all of these activities is that we want to cause more bone formation that's going to increase the strength of our bones and preserve our bones for as long as possible, counteracting the effect of, say, osteoporosis, where the bones become porous and brittle and susceptible to breaking. So short, intense bouts of intense activity where the bones are being loaded, making sure that you recover from those sessions. Much like muscle, the recovery of bone, you need to have a rest period to allow those bones, new bone cells to form. If you don't provide sufficient rest, you don't allow the bone to recover, and it's actually compromising the bone health. So all those things about the sensible formation of an exercise program with that rest period in between, it works for muscles and it also works for bones as well. We have to load the bones. We have to do impact exercises to make those bones work harder and then get the better bone formation. But we also have to ensure that we're resting sufficiently to allow the bones to recover and allow the new bones the bone formation to occur. So some simple things that we can incorporate into our daily lives, but also this exciting new knowledge that we've got, the bones, we were often thinking about these sort of static things that didn't do much. Well, in fact, they're not lying idle. They're actually communicating with other tissues. They're communicating with the muscles. They're communicating with other organs. There's hormones being secreted from one tissue and another. There's crosstalk between these organs, which enable us to do things such as exercise. And if we can a better understanding of that signaling between these different tissues, hopefully we can get clues for devising different interventions and therapies that will improve human health, including frailty, for rehabilitation, for diabetes and so on. So an exciting area of research, Rod.
But how long before we're going to be able to access this? Will it be when you and I are old before there might be a simple injection to improve our bone and muscle health?
Yeah, look, I'm often asked that question even for my own work with muscle diseases and so on, and when we have a breakthrough in a particular thing that we've discovered in severely affected mouse models, how do we translate that to human patients? How long is it going to take? Well, there is when you talked about does it apply in one to the other, it takes time for us to transition and put it into clinical trials. So the same thing for these sorts of discoveries. We've got the potential for a hormone to be synthesized, to be perhaps put back into an older situation and rejuvenate. That's going to take time for testing, the safety. We don't know, the questions that I said before, how much is too much? If we increase the level too high, does it actually compromise the bone health or the muscle health? So these questions take time. That's why the research is so important. We need to invest in those studies. We need to come up with a way that we can package these things in a safe way and deliver it to those that need it. And there are many people in a frail situation that have not recovered from injuries and so on that could benefit from these sorts of advances. And we need to invest in those and, as soon as possible, get them ready so that we can get back and enjoy the quality of life.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Gordon, thank you very much for that exciting news, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Rod.
Gordon Lynch, Health and Fitness.